And welcome. My name's Mark Cunaberti to your Economic Forum, entitled Money Matters. Remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendation or as investment advice or as solicitation to buy or sell any financial products. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative for Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Welcome to the 288th show of Money Matters. Insurance, bonds, markets, and annuities is today's subject. This show is about money. As money doesn't matter, it matters. Money affects us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. It controls our economy, our country, our planet in some way or another. It controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. Okay. So, as always, we have to cover, you know, the large indices. Dow up 140 at 25,680. So we've always described the large numbers below us and above us. 25,680. The support level below us would be the large number, 25,680 points below. Resistance would be 26,000, about 320 points above. However, the technical analysts always have minor and major other resistance points, but the big numbers, 25,000, 26,000, the thousands, are regarded as what some analysts think are important. Obviously, 30,000, that would be a real big one, right? So you could see, you know, if you don't understand resistance and support, just think as the Dow, if it approached 30,000, what a milestone that would be to crawl over 30,000, right? Or let's say it approached 20,000 and dropped below 20,000. That would be a milestone. So these numbers, these larger numbers are generally thought by analysts to have some significance. But remember, there is no theory, methodology, that can predict where the markets will go, because the markets are just the sum of all the players in it on any given day, right? It's the belief of any given day of what people believe. And that's all it is. I always say the markets will reflect reality eventually, but their day-to-day movements are only the views of all the players in it at any one time. So, we have been talking about insurance. It's kind of a fiasco, at least here in Nevada County and probably the brush areas, as you know. I got mine canceled. And a lot of people I know got theirs canceled. And so we did cover a lot of it last show, a couple weeks ago. Actually, I think it was a month ago, a couple of weeks ago, I think we got preempted because if it was some special day, I showed up to do the show and they said, hey, you're not needed. So I hung my head and left. So there you go. So anyway, before we get on to insurance, we'll just talk about the markets a little bit. So, you know, it got to the point I kind of sent an email to a buddy of mine who's also an advisor. And I said, you know, it may be that the market, you know, Trump came out and said he was going to put more tariffs on Mexico. And now they're thinking about delaying Mexican tariffs. And then he said he was going to put more tariffs on China. And in previous announcements about tariffs, the market reacted violently. But when he said that he was going to put 5% tariffs on Mexico, the market did react, but not as much as it normally had. And there's some more information on tariffs today, and the market is kind of not reacting. So, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I think it was, can't quite remember. Trump had been trashing a large internet supplier who you can probably imagine who I'm talking about. And this large internet supplier stock had been around, I don't know, 2000, and it just got hammered down, you know, 40%. I think it was about 40%, 30 or 40%. And every announcement he came out, it kept falling until one day I read a news article that some of the traders were saying, hey, you know, we're not really going to be concerned about what he's saying anymore. This stock's all beaten up. And lo and behold, he kept trashing this particular security, and it stopped moving down. So at that point, I sent a note off to my buddy, and I said, you know, the carnage may be over in this particular security. I don't think they care anymore, what he says. So I'm not saying Trump can't move the markets. We all know he can. But he may not be moving them as much. Maybe people are just saying, oh, the heck with it, you know. So we'll see. Dow high is 26,919, so that's 1,300 points above us. And, you know, when he was elected, it was around 17,000. So we'll see, you know. I'm sure that he's probably got his advisors, his economic advisors, saying, hey, shut up, stop jerking the market around. But, you know, the Donald does what he wants to do, right? Does whatever the heck he wants to do. They probably told him don't tweet anymore when he got elected. It's like, yeah, I ain't doing that. I'm going to do whatever I want. So, okay, whether you like him, love him, hate him, or despise him, you got to admit, he's got you-know-what. I mean, you got to admit. So, okay. Anyway, earnings season was out. First quarter wasn't too bad. It was better than most people would expected. We think that the tariffs kind of chewed into the first quarter. But not as bad, you know, not as bad. Read an article that was out by Weiss Associates that the tariffs are going to smack on about $831 per American family. Now, we talked about the tariffs, and we'll just kind of reiterate that. You know, I wrote an article and put some media out that, and I haven't seen anybody else do that. I'm trying to blow my own horn, but, you know, tariffs are, the original tariffs were put on by Mr. Trump to protect the steel industry. And the you know, and they put a lot of tariffs on foreign cars. I mean, that happened before all this Trump talk came on. And they do that to protect domestic suppliers, domestic being here in the United States. So basically, a car comes over from another country, and the United States government says, okay, we're going to make you pay us another, you know, $2,000 as a penalty or whatever, a tariff, okay? So they charge a company $2,000, and it has to sell its cars here in the U.S. for $2,000 more, raising the price of the foreign car. So what that does, or the theory is that, well, okay, it'll bring a foreign car up to the same price as an American car, and therefore people will have more of an opportunity to buy American. So here, you know, I came out with this article, this idea, and it got a lot of good comments on the idea. And here's the idea. If you want to protect American companies, there's two ways you can do it. You can put a tariff on it, which increases the price of the incoming import. Or you could give a tax break to the American company. Eh? You give them a tax break. You say, okay, instead of a $2,000 tariff, we're going to give you a $2,000 tax credit on each car you sell. The end result would be the same type of protection to the domestic company, right? Whether you add $2,000 to the foreign car or you take away $2,000 for the domestic car, the net effect, at least as far as the nominal price is concerned, is the none. It's zero, right? So the point being is that if you wanted to protect American car companies, you could put a tariff or give them a tax credit. But here's the thing. When you put a tariff on a good or service, the reason this article came out and said tariffs are going to add $831 to each American family is because the price of a good, okay, if it's importable, in other words, if you can buy it from various places, right? You can buy, it's made in America, and it's made in Switzerland, it's made in Japan, it's made in China. Okay, the average price of this good that you would buy in the American market would be the sum of all the prices in it and then averaged out. Some prices would be a little bit higher and some be a little bit lower, but basically the price that you're going to normally see is kind of right in the middle, right? So right in the middle means you've got some higher prices and some lower prices. It's going to be a kind of an average, all things considered being the same, although they aren't in the market, but they would be the average. So if you put a tariff on something, you raise the price of a price dot. In other words, if you got 14 items for sale, they're all the same thing, and they all come from 14 different countries, and you put a tariff on one of them, then the price of all those 14 added together would be higher. So the average price when you put a tariff on something is that the average price of the good, all of them coming in together, is going to be higher because you've increased the value of one of the aspects of the formula on how you raise the price. In other words, if you had three prices, you had $100 and $50 and $150 of three units that were coming in from foreign countries and including the domestic one. So you've got $100, $50, $150. The average of that is $300, right? 100, 150 is 250, and 50 of that is 300, okay? Then you divide it by three, which would be $100, because you've got three inputs, 50, 150, and 100. So the average price of the good would be what? $100. That's what the consumer would normally pay, somewhere around $100. But if you took the higher value, let's say you took the 50, 150, and the 100, and you put a tariff on the 150 and raised it to 200, then you would have a price of 200 plus 100 is 300, 350, then divide that by three, and you come out with the average price being about $117. So the price to the consumer goes up when you put a tariff on one of the things that are coming in. 10 pieces of steel come in, you tariff one of them, raise its price, the average price of steel in the United States will go up. So tariffs, generally, very accepted principle that they cause inflation. They cause the price of whatever you're slapping the tariff on to rise in price domestically. So you could do the same thing and put a tax credit, same protection on a company, helping a company sell more product here. However, if you put a tax credit on, you would lower the price of one of the three figures. So if you had a 50, 100, 150, the average price of that is 300 divided by 3 is 100, and you lowered the $100 to 50 by a tax credit, now you've got the average price of three items. 200 divided by 3 would be what? So at 66. So the price of the good would lower. So in a case of a tariff, you see inflation in whatever the item is that you're slapping the tariff on, and the government gets the money. Right? The consumer pays more and the government gets the money. So basically, what it does is it transfers money from the consumer to the government. That's what it does. Now you think, well, the government gets the tariff. Yeah, the government gets the tariff, but you end up paying more too. So whatever you're paying more goes straight to the government coffers. That's what tariffs do. So I know a lot of steel companies might march around, a lot of companies might march around and say, we like tariffs. I'm going to say, no. I've never seen anybody suggest, why don't you give them a tax credit? Tax credit, then the consumer, you, would get the benefit. The government wouldn't get anything, but the price to the consumer would go down. So my suggestion was, why don't you give everybody a tax credit? Give all the producers, domestic producers, a tax credit. And then the price to us would go down, so we would have more spendable income, because we're spending less on that one item. And not only would we save money on that one item, the economy would get an additional boost because everybody would have a little bit more disposable income. I haven't seen that suggested anywhere, but it makes total sense. So, the government's economic advisory board, they employ, I don't know, how many economists, you tell me. You don't think anybody's actually brought that to them and said, look, why don't you just give them a tax credit instead, and then the consumer saves money. So you got to wonder about the incentive on tariffs. It just fills government coffers and costs you more. So my opinion, tax credit would do the same thing. Protect the domestic suppliers, but the consumers would benefit. Okay. So let's talk about this. Yeah, obviously, we had a lot of fires in Paradise and all over the place. And what happened is we had massive losses by the insurance companies. And so a lot of them pulled back and said, we're not writing any more House policies. Okay? They are allowed to do that. They are allowed to cancel policies anytime they want with a 30-day notice. If you don't pay the premium, they can only send you a 10-day notice. But if they cancel you for whatever reason, they can give you 30-day notice and bingo. So what's happened is a lot of companies that are writing fire policies have no idea what their risk really is now. Global warming, who knows? Lots of fires. In any case, they took it in the shorts in this last go around. And so a lot of companies said, well, we don't really know what our risk is now. We didn't think our risk was this high, and we got railed. So a lot of them pulled back and said, okay, now we ain't writing any fire policies in California. No. So the few companies that were writing them, some were admitted, which means they're in California, and some are not admitted, which means they're outside of California. So what's happening is that, like on auto policy, if you've got a lot of tickets and you're kind of a high-risk driver, you can get insurance, but you have to go through, it's called the accessibility something. It means that what happens is that the Department of Insurance goes to all the auto companies and said, look, okay, we got a lot of people with bad driving records that are high risks, but they have to be able to have insurance to protect the rest of us. So the Department of Insurance basically says, okay, all of you that are selling insurance in California, you're all going to go in on this, and we're going to force you to write these policies, and you're going to charge more, but you have to write them, okay? So the people with bad driving record can get insurance, but you're going to pay more, and it's kind of forced by the Department of Insurance. Well, fire insurance the same way. Fire insurance, a lot of the companies pulled out, but the government, the Department of Insurance knows you have to get fire insurance. So if you can't get fire insurance from anyone else, because you're in an extremely high brush area, they'll route you to the California Fair Plan. Okay? California Fair Plan basically is a consortium that basically has to write insurance policies for fire. So they're the last resort. If you go to the California Fair Plan website, it says, we are the insurer of the last resort. Please check other places before you come here. So if your policy was canceled and your agent said, I'm going to route you to California Fairs because he couldn't get anything else for your homeowner's insurance. Now, I will say there is a differentiation. A differentiation is that there's a dwelling policy and then there's a homeowner's policy. Well, what's the difference? Well, the dwelling policy insures the building, the sticks, right? The nails. That's dwelling. And the homeowner's policy used to insure the dwelling and would insure all the stuff in it, as well as all these other things, medical payments to others, liability, outside structures, and all the rest of the stuff. But now they've separated. So if he routes you or she routes you to the California Fair, you're going to get one policy quote for the dwelling from California Fair. And then your existing insurance company, or perhaps they route you to another, will give you a contents policy. So you'll get basically two policies where you once had one. What I have seen, okay, it's not exclusive, but what I have seen is that my particular homeowner's policy was $1,800 and some change, okay? And I've been routed to California Fair. In fact, I think I meet with my insurance guy tomorrow. And my California Fair quote has come in at $3,800, okay? And the contents policy is coming in at around $12. So where my costs for homeowner's insurance, dwelling and contents, and all the other little add-ons that they give you, is now going to be about $5,000. So it's about 2.5 times. So what I'm seeing by talking to other people who have also had their insurance canceled, a lot of you have, just think, anywhere where there's woods, you're in trouble. Well, it's Nevada County, right? All the way to Paradise to Chico, unless you live in a farm in Redding like my buddy does. So you can expect to pay. We saw one guy that paid 30% more. That was an anomaly. I don't believe that he only paid 30% more. But normally I'm seeing anywhere from 2 to 3 times more. That's what you can expect. Now, it's important. This is very important. Okay? It's important that you know, when I got my quote from Cal Fair, they did not have me fill out a form. They just says, I had sent them an old policy. And what they did is they looked up the stats on my house. So when I got the policy, I was looking at the policy and it said slab house. Well, my house is not a slab. It's a raised foundation. It had three bedrooms, three baths. My house has four bedrooms, four baths. And it didn't have a theft and vandalism. Riot. Public what do they call that? Unrest. So I contacted them and I said, you don't have the right information. I got four bedrooms, four baths, not three and three. And I'm on a raised foundation, not a slab. And they said, well, we just pulled up the thing that your, you know, your stats on your house, public records. So they had to requote. So, you know, it's important that, and this was from a valid insurance agent, you know, that came in and said, you know, hey, this is what, this is your quote. So I had to go back and say, okay, you got to revise this, you know. So it's important, you know, the insurance policies are fairly, you know, they can be a little complicated, declarations page and the conditions and exclusions and endorsements, you know, they can be a little complicated, but they will give you a description of your house and it'll say bedrooms and foundation. And you got to look at that and see if they're correct. And if they're not correct, or you don't know if they're correct, you better get somebody to help you look at it and see if it is correct. Because if it's wrong, you know, I had one person, I saw him on a, yeah, I belong to a neighborhood app. You know, it has an app that all the neighbors kind of post in your neighborhood. And she said, well, I actually had paid the same price. And I came back and I said, you look, you know, you better check because I don't think it's even possible that you paid the same price. There's no way because it's probably not the same coverage. And, you know, they could, she did not come back and comment, but I'm sure she might have said, you know, well, they gave me the policy. Doesn't matter. The agent that I was talking to made a mistake, so yours could too. So it is important that you look at the policy. But that's what's going to happen. Now, what I think also is going to happen is that, you know, the companies are in business to write insurance policies. So the ones that are now not writing anymore, it is my opinion that the Department of Insurance and the companies themselves want to write in California. They just don't know what their risk is now because they took it in the shorts in this last go-around with all the fires. So right now, everybody's scrambling, and you're going to have to take what you can get. You know, take a look at it. And if it's a California fair plan and a wrap plan, the wrap plan being the smaller of the two prices that you're going to pay, two different policies, you might be able to shop the wrap plan, but that's the smaller of the two amounts by a lot. But if it's coming from California Fair, there's not, I don't think, in my opinion, there's not going to be much difference. So if you've got a quote, you know, that right now, you better run with it. I've talked to a few people that were uninsured. They didn't know what to do, and it lapsed. So they had no coverage. So when they contacted me, I said, you got to get coverage, man. You got to go now and get it because you don't know what's going to happen. Somebody leaves your stove on and wham. So what I think is going to happen is the insurance companies that are not writing and that used to write are going to have a powwow and a teepee and do a smoke and figure out what their real risks are. And then they're going to come back next year and start quoting again. And then there's going to be another. Right now, it's like, hurry up. You're going to get canceled in 30 days and get a posse. But I think next year when when it starts renewing, some of these companies are going to start to come back because they're going to realize exactly what their risk is and they're going to start writing again. And then you'll have a little more time, you know, to shop. So the time to start shopping for a renewal. If you're going to actively, you know, before we used to just say, okay, my policy's coming back. How much do I owe you? And bingo, you pay the money. Well, about 2 or 3 months before your policy expires again, because they expire every year usually, 2 or 3 months you start talking to people, okay? And saying, you know, my policy expires in 2 months, 3 months, and I want us to get some quotes and see who's going to be more competitive. I can't guarantee that everybody's going to come back, but it's my opinion that they will come back. And then it'll be a little bit more calm. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station, and we'll be right back.
money than you have ever seen. Maybe I just want all the frills. I'm gonna insulate my body.
All right. Well, with the market jumping up and down and over, I'm telling you, it's been just volatile. I mean, you know, the October, November, December sell-off was the worst since 08 and 09, in the opinion of a CNBC article. And you can find the stats that basically verify that, you know, that the last fall... October started October 1st, almost to the day, ended December 24th, was the worst one that we've seen since 08-09. It really took a lot of money out of the market. And a lot of stocks are still down from that particular sell-off. Brutal. And then it went up starting January. And then, of course, we had another turnaround setback. So I covered this before, and I'll cover this again. This is on an annuity, and people don't understand what an annuity is, and so we're going to talk about that. We have a big disclaimer at the end. This has been approved by my regulator under 232089. So just my regulator will listen to the show, and he'll say, did he approve that? Yes, I did. And I do have the huge disclaimer at the end, so we'll have to bear with me. But an annuity is a contract between someone and an insurance company, okay? Okay. Normally, let's just do a simple annuity, okay? Simple annuity is my own term for it, but a simple idea of concept is you give an insurance company a lump sum. Now, you can pay them over time too, but let's just keep it simple here, okay? Now, I can tell you I wasn't a big fan of annuities for the longest time. I saw too many of them with high fees, complicated terms, and so many hooks I had to get my tackle box out to house them all. That said, when I started offering annuities to clients with specific needs and desires not so long ago, I reviewed literally hundreds of them, and I only found a few that I thought were advantageous. So it's a contract between, let's say, you and an insurance company that stipulates in return for a sum of money paid by the client, you, the company will promise payments over a period of time, starting right away, or starting later, or return a lump sum later. Okay, so you can income now, income later, or a lump sum, or a quantity, or a combination of both. Annuities are contracts. As a contract, they have all sorts of versions and terms, but just know the contract is a promise to pay. You give them money, and they promise to pay you back. Now, it's not guaranteed by the U.S. government, okay? It's guaranteed by an underlying insurance company, okay? So, how and when and how much they pay you depends on the contract, right? All the insurance companies that write annuities, they all have different ones. The annuity can be tied to a specific thing such as a stock index, be invested in stocks, or they can just be, you know, they can pay you based on the stock index, but just as a guide to them. You may not own any stocks, but they may say, hey, if it's sunny 5 days in a row, I'll pay you 2%. Same thing with stock market. They say, hey, if stock market goes up by this amount, I'll pay you this much. Okay. There are many, many varieties and many, many variations of these things. Okay. what some investors like about annuities, okay, and some of these, what we call an income annuity, the term is used, you won't outlive your money. Now, that's kind of a simplistic statement. You know, if you gave me $100 and I gave you 1/100th of a penny a year, you wouldn't outlive your money, right? Because you're not going to live that long. So, but let's say on an income annuity, you give them some money and then you wait, you let it marinate for a long time. And then at a certain point, predetermined by you or determined by you on the fly as you grow older, you say, pay me. And the insurance company looks at what you gave them and they have a formula that they'll arrive at, or many formulas. They can be very complicated. Trust me, I've seen a lot of them, and some of them are very complicated, and I don't like the complicated ones myself. They look at that and they say, okay, we can pay you this amount for 20 years, or we can pay you this amount for the rest of your life. And they can even say, we can pay you this amount for the rest of your life and the rest of the life of your spouse or significant other. So true, they won't outlive your money. However, how much you get for the rest of your life is dependent on their formulas. Now, usually a annuity company, insurance company, and whoever you purchase this thing through, will give you what they call an illustration, an approved illustration. An approved illustration is kind of a graph, can be a graph, that'll show you what'll happen based on your age and what'll happen if certain things happen. What'll happen if you take a guaranteed annuity, which is saying we'll give you something percent a month, or something percent a year for the rest of your life, they'll give you an illustration of that. If you base it on representative of underlying stock index, like the S&P 500 or something of that sort, they'll say, if the S&P does this, this is what you'll make. If the S&P does that, this is what you'll make. They usually have a retroactive graph that says, this is what happened in the last 10 years, how much you would have made, or the last 7 years, or whatever it is. And usually the ones I've seen says, this is what you have made in a down market, in an up market, and in a flat market, okay? Okay. So I find that investors sometimes prefer annuities because there's, in essence, unlike a stock account, you watch the balance go all over the place and you freak out if it goes lower. You know, you already know from the approved illustration what you're going to get in certain types of annuities. If you have a fixed annuity where they say, we're going to pay 1% a year for the rest of your life or whatever, you know what you're going to get. So you don't really care about the stock market, what it does, because your annuity basically says, this is what I'm going to get. So I find that certain investors will ask me for an annuity because they don't want to watch balance. You know, they don't want to watch a balance. They want to know what they're going to get. They want it written in stone, and they that was it. And I can't really fault them for that. You know, for people that are very, very nervous or don't like their stocks bouncing around, if you have faith in the underlying insurance company, and many of these are very, very big, and they're rated too. You know, you could ask for the rating. They normally won't give you the insurance company's rating in the quote, but you can look it up or ask. They won't give you the rating in the quote. And so some of these are by these insurance companies that you heard on television, and some of these are those that you haven't heard of. So for those that don't want to see a moving balance, that may be a way to go. The ones that I lean forward, because there's so many complicated ones, I study them for an hour or two and I still don't understand them, and I'm in the business. The annuities that I personally lean towards are the ones that are straight and straightforward and simple. The terms are clear, and there's usually not a whole lot of them compared to some of the others. My thinking is, if I can explain it to a client and they understand how it works, it will be better for all concerned, which is the investor, me, the advisor, and the insurance company writing the contract. I will tell you that the regulations and oversights on annuities is severe. When you apply for one, they're going to want to know everything about you, and they can turn you down. They'll say, no, this guy's not appropriate for an annuity. But the regulations are strict. The protection to the customer is a lot better than it was decades ago, where the annuities were kind of like a black box. Many are simple, easy to understand, and perform as promised. Now, you may not understand completely everything about the annuity, although you should. I would say that most people don't. Most people that I've talked to that have an annuity can't explain it back to me. They just know that somebody sold them one. know that annuities usually are time products. In other words, insurance companies promise you a certain thing in response to your money, but they want your money for a while. Okay, they want to invest it and use it and make money from it. So that's how they can guarantee you some sort of return or a minimum return, is that you get the use for your money. So if you want to take your money out early or change your mind, then they're going to hit you with prepayment penalties. Normally, on the annuities that I've seen, if you hold the annuity through the term and don't violate any of the terms, then there are no prepayment penalties, because those only apply if you pre take money out before the contract allows you to. Some of them do allow you to take out a certain amount percent a year after the first year or so. Some allow you to do that, and some don't. So basically know that you know, as a diversified portfolio, in my opinion, an annuity might have a consideration for you. Even if you're not paranoid, there are some things that people should consider when looking at these products. I have seen investors that have a lot of them, and in my opinion, too many of them. And the reason being is because, unlike if you manage somebody's money, they usually get paid over a long period of time, small amount. Annuities will pay the guy who sold it to you, usually, sometimes up front, or they'll pay him every year, or they'll pay him at the end. So they do make a commission on these things. And it's not in the contract what the commission is. The commission is, you know, paid out of the prepayment penalty if you take it out early, or the commission is paid by the money that the insurance company made while they used yours. So annuities, sure, they might have a place for consideration for you. And so don't let the term scare you off, but just try to understand. Have somebody try to understand and explain to you what it is. Now, here's the disclaimer. In a written article, it must be in bold and in larger font, so I'm going to raise my voice and read the disclaimer. So just assume that this is in bigger font, in bold. Investors should consider the investment objective, risks, fees, and expenses before investing. For this and other important information, please obtain the investment company fund prospectus and disclosure documents from your rep advisor. Read this information carefully before investing. Guarantees are based on the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurance company. Okay? All right. And finally, you know, I do get a lot of questions about the relationship between bonds and interest rates. You know, how do they react to each other, okay? And it's kind of interesting. One of the most difficult concepts for investors to understand is the relationship between bonds and interest rates. Your bond, if you bought one, IOU from whoever, that's what a bond is. Bonds are just IOUs, and although many investors can't describe exactly what a bond is, it's easy as rereading the last sentence or rehearing the last sentence, it's an IOU. It means when you buy a bond, you are loaning money to something, someone, some entity, some person, some municipality. For the loan, you'll hopefully get your money back in lieu of what is called a default, where you lose some or part of your money. And you get paid a, what I call a gratuity, but it's basically an interest rate or, you know, something of that sort. The gratuity is just the annual interest rate you'll be paid, either periodically, installment payments, like quarterly, semi-annually, annually, or at the end of the loan. They can say, I'll give you all the interest at the end. That's called a zero coupon. Now, if you buy a bond today, when interest rates move in the general economy, it can affect the price of certain bonds more than others because of a mechanism called opportunity cost. So, how does that work? Well, assume that you agree to lend out your money for a day, only a day, okay, and you buy an IOU, or you buy a day bond. There's no such thing as a day bond, but I'm just making it up. Let's say the day bond pays 5%. Some guys agree to pay you 5% tomorrow. Pretty good. Let's say that interest rates in the economy are commensurate with the bond rate, 5%. And now tomorrow, today, after you buy the bond, the interest rates in the economy move to 10%. Okay? Now, you'll still get your 5% tomorrow, but you're losing 5% because now you could buy a bond for 10, right? That's the opportunity cost. If you hold your bond till tomorrow, you'll get 5%. If you want to sell your bond today because you changed your mind and bond markets are liquid and you buy a bond, you can resell it if it's a publicly traded bond, obviously. If you want to sell the bond, they'll say, well, your bond's only paying 5 and a guy could buy a bond today for 10, but we have to make the market liquid. You have to be able to sell it in case you need it. So they'll say, okay, how much did your bond cost?
$1,000.
Well, it's only paying 5 when a guy can do 10. So we're only going to give you $950. So they discount the bond price if you want to sell it before the term is up. Now, in a day bond, because it's only a day, they probably wouldn't even discount the bond more than a penny or so. But let's say you bought a 30-year bond and you bought it at 5%. And you're going to be in that bond for 30 years at 5%. And then interest rates rise to 10. Well, you're losing 5%. And over 30 years, I can add up to a lot of money. So generally speaking, if the bond has a very longer term than, let's say, a bond that has a shorter term, when interest rates rise, the price of the bond in the resale market will fall. Okay? So if you bought a 30-day bond, we call it usually a 30-day treasury, and interest rates rise, that 30-day bond is not going to move much in price if you had to sell it early. Keep it to the end, you're going to get what the interest rate says, but you're not going to get the current rate if it rises, if the interest rates rise in the economy. But if you buy a 30-year bond, yeah, you'll get your 5% at the end of 30 years, but you take it in the shorts because you could have gotten 10 for 30 years if you waited a day. So in that particular case, just know that in a 30-year bond, if interest rates rise, the price of the bond, if you had to sell it, would likely fall in price and you would get less. That's how they market the bond. It's only paying 5, but you're only paying half of what it's worth. So let's say you got a $1,000 bond, you paid $500 because it's paying 5% and the interest rates in the economy are 10. You paid $500. When the bond matures at the end of 30 years, you're going to get your 1,000 back because that's how much a bond is worth. But you took it in shorts, $500 over the term. So just know, now that may have, it's a pretty quick explanation, but just know that the longer term the bond or the longer term the bond fund. Now, on a bond fund, you could say a long bond fund, you know, longer term bond fund or an intermediate bond fund. That means the terms are kind of in the middle. The longer the bond fund maturity that they hold 30-year bonds, or the longer the individual bond that you hold 30-year bond, if interest rates rise, then that bond is going to be discounted and you could lose money if you decide to sell early. Conversely, if rates fell, then the price of the bond, if you wanted to sell early, could go up. So interest rates rise around you. Bonds are going to generally fall in price when you go to resell them or buy them. Okay? If interest rates fall, the bond prices will rise. So that's the interaction between the two. Interest rates rise, short-term bonds, generally not much movement. Long-term bonds, lots of movement. Interest rates fall, short-term bonds, not much movement. Long-term bonds, they're going to move more. So you're going to buy an individual bond from a city or a company or whatever, an individual bond, or you can buy a bond fund. And if you're going to buy a bond fund, you want to look at what, you know, how long are the terms of the bonds that they hold. If you buy a long-term bond fund and it holds nothing but 30-year bonds, you could be susceptible to that bond fund falling in price if rates rise. And conversely, if rates fall, then the opposite would happen. Okay? All right. A lot of investors do own bonds, but they don't understand this relationship on interest rates. So interest rates rise, bonds usually fall, longer-term bonds fall. Interest rates fall, longer-term bonds generally will rise. Due to what? Opportunity cost. There you go. Okay, so I hope that's kind of helped you along the way. You have been listening to Money Matters. This has been show 288 today. They're just kind of clicking along, you know. 288 shows. Wow. So, the website for more information is an Agrata website. There's no charge. It's our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station, moneymanagementradio.com. The website for your community radio station, you can look up ours, where the show emanates from in Nevada City, California, is kvmr.org. But the show is picked up and aired on other stations, usually at other times, okay? And this has been show number 288. And I'm looking for my title page here so I can remember what I called it. Oh, I can't find it. Well, I think it was 288. Markets, insurance, annuities, and more. Please be advised that the show is not to be construed as investment advice. Please consult with your financial advisor or a financial expert before making any decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and may not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, the station, its staff, management, or underwriters. Indices mentioned may not be invested in directly. Remember, investing involves a risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. And if you want a guaranteed product, okay, they allow me to say that for guarantee, government FDIC-insured savings and CDs. Right? Even treasuries can move in value in a resale market. So for investors that say, I don't want any risk at all, then it would be government guaranteed CDs and savings. They're not paying a lot, you know. Problem with holding the CDs and savings is that if inflation comes along, you're going to be stuck, not so much in a savings account, but if you got a longer-term CD, you're stuck. And much like a bond, the opportunity cost is going to be brutal. Okay, my name is Mark Cunaberti. You are listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And I'll just tell you, where the Dow is today, we'll finish up the store. Dow is up 181. NASDAQ up 36. S&P up 16. And so there you go. If you have any questions, feel free to direct the questions to the program director on your station. And I think you can contact me through moneymanagementradio.com as well. My name is Mark. God bless. Have a great day. Remember, money isn't the only thing. Your faith, your family, your health, spirituality, help your community. These are the things that matter the most. Have a great day.